Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution. Hello, I'm Andrew McDermott. How do we make ethical and wise public policy decisions as we navigate the coronavirus pandemic? Today, my guest is neurosurgeon Dr. Michael Agnor, professor of neurosurgery and pediatrics at the State University of New York, Stony Brook. Dr. Agnor is an award-winning brain surgeon who has been named one of New York's best doctors in New York Magazine. He also writes regularly for evolutionnews.org, the flagship news and commentary site of Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Andrew.
At evolutionnews.org, you recently shared a sensible framework to help leaders and experts make more effective public policy decisions during the coronavirus pandemic. First, you're a neurosurgeon. What firsthand experience have you had with the coronavirus?
Well, I work in a large public hospital on Long Island. And while as a neurosurgeon, I don't directly treat patients for coronavirus infection, I'm in the hospital and I see the consequences of the coronavirus issues. And I do have patients who have coronavirus who also have neurosurgical problems. So I'm very much in that world, and it's been a very traumatic and a very busy time.
Yeah. Well, as with all of us, you've had some time to really look at what's going on around us. And in this framework that you've put together, the first advice you give is that experts must keep in their lane. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that we depend upon scientific experts particularly for accurate, clear scientific advice. It's very clear in this situation that our scientific experts failed us, and they failed us in a way that is catastrophic and that is historic. It's hard to think of a scientific failure on this magnitude in recent history. Basically, the only job of the World Health Organization, or certainly the primary job, and the primary job of the Center for Disease Control and many other scientists in government is to prevent pandemics. And that's exactly what they didn't do. Even though it was known in the fall that there was an outbreak of a potentially very dangerous virus in China. And China has had this happen repeatedly. These kind of viruses every few years arise in China. And there was evidence early on, back November, December, that this was a particularly dangerous virus. And our scientists didn't warn us and didn't help us with this. And you have to ask, for example, when there was evidence this virus was beginning to spread in Wuhan, say back in November or December, why didn't the World Health Organization or the Centers for Disease Control go to the president and say, we need to close our borders to people traveling from these areas because it's putting our population in danger? I'm unaware of any recommendation to that effect. In fact, from what I gather, the president would have been accused of xenophobia and all sorts of things had he done that. So I'm not aware of any recommendation that we close our borders really until the borders were closed in late January. And the question is why? Because frankly, it's obvious that that's the way you control a pandemic. It's not particularly advanced science. You do social distancing, and you can socially distance a country just like you can socially distance people. And my suspicion is that the reason that the scientific community didn't immediately recommend closing our borders to people who could be infected was because of political considerations. And I think the politics may have bled over into the science. So it was the responsibility of the scientists to give our leaders scientific advice. You know, stay in your lane. What's the scientific response to evidence for a new and dangerous virus arising elsewhere in the world? Well, honestly, there's one main scientific response, and that is don't let people who carry that virus into your country. And that's what the scientists didn't do. And I think it's because they didn't stay in their lane. They were probably thinking, well, you know, this is politically difficult. I don't know how we can do this. And it watered down what their scientific recommendation should have been.
Mm. The next advice you give is that political policymakers should be transparent with their calculus. First, remind us about a few terms here. What is really meant when we say political, and what do you mean by a leader's calculus?
Well, By political, I mean the people in government who are in a position to make policy decisions and to enforce those decisions. Scientists, you know, give advice. Economists give advice. Military people give advice, etc. But it's the, you know, it's the president. It's the members of Congress and Senate. It's executives in the executive branch of the government who can actually make decisions that are put into effect. So when I say political people, I mean, people like the president, people like his advisors who are in positions to actually enforce policies. And I'm sorry, what was the second part of that?
Yeah, no. Why should policymakers be transparent? Have we seen that? And why is that important?
The reason for transparency is because these decisions, first of all, are being made in a democratic republic. So the actual decision makers ultimately in this country is us, the people. So the people ought to be aware of the basis for these decisions. And they should be transparent because there are always upsides and downsides of any decision. We could, for example, decide to reorganize our society and our economy to absolutely minimize the risk of transmission of the virus. That would save as many lives as possible in that respect. However, it would destroy our economy, destroy our society, and could in the long run lead to untold misery and suffering and even death. Even though we wouldn't be dying from the virus, we might be dying from a depression, from civil war, from all kinds of problems. So what our leaders need to do is to say, if we open our economy now, and if we open it to this extent, in this way, what is the likely effect on the death rate from the virus? You know, are we going to have a 1% increase in the death rate if we avoid a Great Depression over the next 3 months? Or is there going to be a 50% increase in the death rate if we avoid a Great Depression? So the public ought to know the calculus. They ought to know, if we reopen right now, what risks are we running? Because ultimately, the public in this democracy is sovereign. They're the ones ultimately responsible.
Well, thirdly, you say that final public policy decisions must be well-informed and must be made on sound ethical guidelines. Tell us about Thomas Aquinas's principle of double effect, which is the basis for much of Western law and ethics.
Well, decision-making in this pandemic is a very good example of the problem that St. Thomas Aquinas addressed in his principle of double effect. What St. Thomas said was that when we decide to do something, to take a particular action, and we want to evaluate the moral status of that action, is it right to do or wrong to do? He said it's usually a mixed bag. That is, practically anything we do has some aspects that are morally good and some aspects that are morally bad. An example in modern times would be the decision in the morning to get up and drive into work. We normally think of that as a morally good decision. You know, you have to support your family, meet your responsibilities at work, so you get in a car and you drive in. However, you might have an accident going into work, and you might kill somebody. You might hit a pedestrian. So how do you balance that risk? Do you just curl up in bed and never go out to work? Well, that has its risks too. So Thomas Aquinas said, in order to evaluate the morality of an action where either good or bad things might happen because of the action, you need to satisfy four criteria to call it a morally good action. The first thing you need to do is you need to intend the good outcome and not intend the bad outcome. And those are two criteria. You need to intend the good outcome. That is, if I want to go into work, I'm intending to go and do my job and support my family and do right by my employer and my colleagues. And that's good. I'm not intending to run over any pedestrians on the way there, even though that might happen. That's always a remote possibility. On the other hand, if I get up in the morning and I know my neighbor Joe takes a walk and I really don't like my neighbor Joe, and I figure, hey, on the way into work, I could just sideswipe Joe as I'm driving by and, you know, get back at him. Well, that's morally bad. So Aquinas would say that even though in both cases, let's say you accidentally hit your neighbor on the way into work, or you intentionally hit your neighbor, well, if you accidentally hit him, it was still a good moral decision to go into work because you weren't intending to harm him. But if you did intend to harm him, it's bad. So you have to intend the good and not intend the bad. The third criterion is that the good has to be much more likely than the bad. That is, you have to weigh the risks and benefits. Say, for example, I'm driving into work on a beautiful day in the summer. It's a lovely day, perfect weather, I go into work. That's a good thing to do. On the other hand, if there's a blizzard, and the roads are treacherous, and I don't have snow tires, maybe that's a day to stay home. Because maybe that day, driving into work carries too high a risk. So Aquinas would say, you know, you can intend the good, not intend the bad, but you also have to be realistic about the relative risk of good happening as opposed to bad. So you have to have a pretty good chance of having a good workout. His fourth criterion, which is in many ways the most subtle, and I think the one that is the most easily violated, but it's a critical criterion, is that you can't use the bad aspects of what you plan to do as the means to accomplish the good. An example is Robin Hood. Robin Hood would go out and he would rob people and he'd take their money and he would give it to the poor. Well, giving poor people money is basically a pretty good thing. But robbing people is a bad thing. The problem was that Robin Hood used the bad thing to accomplish the good thing. So the bad thing was the means by which he did the good thing, and that, according to Aquinas, is not moral. So you can't deliberately do something evil, even if it's going to have a good outcome. To use another example, you couldn't deliberately kill someone to take their organs to use them for transplant. You know, I mean, every person walking around has 7 or 8 organs that could be taken out and given to other people. And that person could save 7 or 8 lives. But it would be grossly unethical to kill a person to do that, even though you'd save a lot of people. So you can't do evil to accomplish good. So that whole system of ethics, which is often called the principle of double effect, really is the cornerstone of Western law. A lot of our legal reasoning comes from Aquinas' principle of double effect. It's a system of medical ethics and everyday ethics. It's the way we tend to think. And I think making decisions in the pandemic needs to be based, number one, on good information that the scientists and the economists and all the people who advise the president and advise the decision makers have to present the president and our decision makers with unbiased, accurate scientific advice. And our decision makers should be transparent about what their calculus is, about what the risks and benefits are. And they should use Aquinas' principle of double effect to make sure that we do the right thing. So we need to apply a framework for moral decision making that makes sense and that's effective. And I think that framework is the most effective one we have.
Well, Dr. Agnor, these are great reminders, both for the public at large, as we all face our personal decisions in life, and the leaders to which you're directing them. I sure hope the president gets wind of some of this, either from you or from other sensible individuals who are thinking along the same lines. So important as we move through this troubling and challenging time to have some clear thinking, some effective thinking, and some ethical thinking. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Andrew.
To read more of Dr. Agnor's writing on evolution and intelligent design, you can go to evolutionnews.org. Just click the Writers tab near the top and choose Michael Agnor. And for more episodes of ID the Future, go to idthefuture.com or just subscribe on your favorite podcasts platform. I'm Andrew McDermott for ID the Future. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.